This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that will lift everything in the room. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
Why is it, you think, that of all the professions in the world, you chose podcasting? You could have been a tax accountant, you could have owned your own gym, you could have opened a chain of restaurants, you could have done 10,000 things. In the end, you chose podcasting. You made that decision, and I can't find that very, very interesting.
Hey, this is Chris, and they say this one has a surprise ending.
In this episode, we're discussing Unbreakable, starring Bruce Willis, Samuel L. Jackson, Robin Wright Penn, Spencer Treat Clark, Charlene Woodard, and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. Well, it comes to be that this is the year that we finally get around to the Shamhammer, as he's belovedly known on the internets. Gentlemen, I have to ask, what is your familiarity with M. Night Shyamalan and with this movie?
Oh, with Shyamalan, I think my first one of his was Sixth Sense. And honestly, I think my only two I've seen are Sixth Sense and this one. If I recall correctly, originally this was on our maybe list when it came out in theaters, and one of my coworkers went to see it and came back and said, "Dude, it's a comic book movie." And we're looking at him like, "What?" It's like, "Yes, go see it. It's a comic book movie. Oh, shut up now. Go." Like, okay, so.
And this was only, what, about 4 months after X-Men?
Something like that. Maybe not even. I don't even think that long.
Well, no. X-Men came out in August, and this came out in November.
This is November.
Wow.
So, 3 months.
I will say, actually, before I do, Chris, what is your familiarity with Knight and his movies?
I've seen the majority of his stuff, but Sixth Sense was spoiled for me before I saw it, so I did not like it. And Unbreakable is like actually before Split, it was my favorite Shyamalan movie. So yeah.
All right, so I'm going to make a massive confession here and say that I have seen each in every one of M. Night Shyamalan's films in theaters, with the exception of Standing Still, his first one. I forgot the name of it, but
you admit to Airbender.
Yeah, it was his drama that he made for Miramax. And when I saw The Sixth Sense, I'll be honest here, I honestly thought it was the pilot for a TV show. I was expecting there to be a Sixth Sense TV show within about like 3 or 4 months after the movie came out. It got Oscar buzz, which I was really surprised about. Like, I mean, it was an okay movie, but seriously? Best Picture? I didn't buy that at all. I really thought that Haley Joel Osment had a lot of potential on him. And he did some other interesting stuff in his career afterwards. But I really didn't think that M. Night Shyamalan was all that. And then came Unbreakable. And I will say that Unbreakable was a movie that I thought was vastly better than Sixth Sense when I initially saw it. And then, of course, came Signs, which, and I'll go ahead and spoil it right now, I consider to be one of the best films of all time, in my opinion.
Oh, wow.
And I know that that's controversial, and I will defend it to death, so bring it. After that, I've defended The Village a little bit more than I probably would like to say that I have. My falling out with Shyamalan happened during Lady in the Water. And ever since, is one of those things where it's like, I know that he has good movies in him. I just wish that he knew that he had good movies in him. And then The Visit came and kind of gave a brief glimpse. And then Split really did open things wide open for him again. And yeah, so I'm super excited about what he's going to be doing next, considering that the title of the next one is called Glass. Hint, hint, yeah. Hint. So yeah, I'm very eager to see what comes next for Shyamalan. But I will say that I am, even with all of his failures, and his failures are spectacular, I consider myself a fan of it. Because the thing I notice about Shyamalan's work is that he's full of passion. He's a very passionate individual. His movies are filled with passion, and he's trying to aim for more than just schlocky fun. And that's part of his downfall, but at the same time, though, I've seen other filmmakers who don't give as much care to their movies that are so more blatantly commercial. And to me, I don't know. It's one of those things, like, I just hope that he would just kind of, you know, figure out what he need, you know, figure out what works for him and stick to it. And like I said, now it looks like he's getting back on that path. And of course, I'm probably going to be eating my words in a year's time. So let's talk about Unbreakable. Now, as Kent, you've mentioned, this is now considered a comic book movie. But the funny thing about this is that the way that the film was promoted was that this was going to be kind of another Sixth Sense type of movie, that this was going to kind of deliver the same kind of thrills that Sixth Sense was going to go for. It not at all, at any point in the trailers, they even bring up comic books. In fact, it would be the opening scroll that would give us the indication that comic books would even be a part of this movie. So what did you think about how the implementation of comic book mythos in this movie, and especially considering that this came out the same year as X-Men?
It breaks it down pretty much like any form of, I mean, you talk to any comic book writer, and pretty much that's what Elijah says. It's like, oh, you've got this, you've got X, Y, Z happens, blah, blah, blah. Everything he says is exactly, I almost want to say, industry standard for comics when he's trying to explain what's going on. And the thing is, over the whole course of the movie, it's right there in front of you. Mm-hmm. So,
well, Chris, out of curiosity, what is your affinity towards comic book movies? And does this film kind of meet that criteria?
I'm kind of a sucker for most superhero movies. It's just not DC lately. But I mean, I'm still a sucker for Marvel stuff, even though, like, the formula's been the same since, what, Iron Man? So, I mean, but with Unbreakable, it's like it's different, but at the same time, it's like there's a familiarity to it that you're like, once it all comes together, you're like, oh, I know this, but I don't know it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, if that makes sense at all.
To put in comic perspective, if you've got a DC and a Marvel, this feels like some sort of indie title. Ooh, indie comic book title. I know, not indie film, but indie
Image, comic.
could be one of the Image titles, could be one of the even smaller presses. So, because Image is creator comes in, here's an idea. They're not really a universe. This is becoming a universe, which we'll talk about later. But it is an indie comic book.
Well, I don't know. For me, I think that you got a bit of a point, but I also have to say that I love the highly stylistic visual look that this film has in regards to how it sets up the characters and how it sets up little motifs. One thing that I should go ahead and mention on the creative side is that the cinematographer here is Eduardo Serra.
Yeah.
And Eduardo Serra, prior to this film, you know, he did a movie called What Dreams May Come with Robin Williams, which is an incredibly beautiful looking film.
Yes.
He does a lot of period type films, and he uses a lot of naturalistic lighting with a lot of his films. But with What Dreams May Come, because most of it is set in heaven, so to say, it has a very unique color palette to it. And I want to say that that was the movie that got him Unbreakable. And what I find very interesting here is how, unlike with The Sixth Sense, who had the great Tak Fujimoto doing that particular film, and he would go on to do Signs later on, who loves to use color color signifiers to let you know beats that are happening. Here, what he does is he uses lighting signifiers. The lights get brighter or darker depending on the tone that the film is trying to set in towards the characters. If you'll notice, whenever we get to Mr. Glass, there's a lot of purple, a lot of kind of not exactly dark, but not exactly light. Whenever we see David in his natural setting, it's a lot of gray, kind of signifying, you know, his particular journey. And it gets a little brighter as we get later into the film, and then it ends, you know, with him kind of moving into the light. So he uses more lighting signifiers than color palettes, so to say, for this particular film. And a lot of it, I have to say, is because, well, let's just put it this way. 1 year had lapsed between Sixth Sense and Unbreakable. Shyamalan did not waste any time in getting into this particular film. In fact, I want to say that he had already had this film written before The Sixth Sense had even been released. And a part of the special features that he had for his Unbreakable DVD, he made it very clear that he wanted to hurry up and get this out there before people kind of pigeonholed him, which, looking back at it now, was extremely hilarious. Let's be honest here. I mean,
what's a twist?
Yeah.
I mean, well, hell. I mean, Robot Chicken, which was the ones that coined that. What a twist!
What a twist!
You know, that was Robot Chicken, and that was their take on M. Night Shyamalan. But yeah, I think that that those types of images do kind of give it a little bit of a comic book feel, especially an indie comic feel. And I bet that in a way you could turn Unbreakable into a comic book.
Oh, yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
But as a film, though, let's go ahead and let's get into this. Because the film starts off with a very interesting prologue, so to say. Where it's set in, what, 1965?
Mid-60s, yeah.
And so. What do we think about this opener with the doctor kind of finding this lady in the middle of a department store who had just given birth, and that the baby's arms and legs are broken? What do we take of this opener?
What's wrong with the baby?
Well,
I mean, it gets explained fairly quickly, but yeah, it's still a panic.
Actually, well, it takes about... What?
Well, yeah, I guess maybe half an hour or so for it.
Yeah, about 25 minutes to 30 minutes till we get an explanation. In fact, we don't see that baby all grown up until about 20 minutes into the film, right?
Because a lot of that's because we have to see Bruce Willis on the train, but...
Yeah, but I think it's interesting that the film opens with this being kind of a callback to Elijah. Specifically, that because with a prologue, you want the prologue to be the main character's opener, right? You want this to be an understanding of the main character. In this case, this is going to be what I think the film was intended to be a side character. But looking back at it now, I'm wondering if perhaps I was misunderstanding the film. But I thought that this was David's film when, in fact, this is Elijah's film. And I wonder, maybe that's the real twist in the film. And I think maybe that was the twist that no one understood about the film. Even now, I think that people still consider that to be Bruce Willis's film. You know, that in a way, it was kind of like Sixth Sense in that sense that with that film, and I'm going to go ahead and spoil it for those who don't know, the film was throwing itself to be Bruce Willis's film, but it turns out to be Haley Joel Osment's film. But in that sense, the prologue was a Bruce Willis, right?
Yes.
I don't know.
I was trying to remember how that film went. It's like, oh yeah, because it's his, not to spoil it, but origin.
Yeah,
oh, shit, okay.
No, we'll go ahead and throw it out there. And I've already mentioned that there is spoilers going to be for The Sixth Sense here. Because in a way, you can't talk about Shyamalan's films at all without explaining the twists that those films go for. At the same time, though, I'm going to say that my admiration of Shyamalan twists have kind of been a little unimpressive, primarily because I'm starting to see better twists in films and in TV shows. And they were actually better before Shyamalan, but even now that twists have kind of are kind of a thing that you find in a lot of films more recently, that a lot of them do better jobs of kind of setting up those twists than Shyamalan. What Shyamalan basically is begging you to figure out what the twist is before the movie, before you get to the twist, right? And I get that sense, especially with this movie. They were wanting you to look for the twist. It's like, come on, figure it out, figure it out, figure it out, figure it out. And to me, I don't know. Now that I'm kind of looked at this film with that in mind, it does kind of affect how I see the film. Did y'all have this problem watching it recently?
I didn't. Kind of like, I know Shyamalan's associated with twists, but like after he kind of lulled, it was just kind of like, just make a good movie, man. I don't give a shit about a twist, you know? And like, but with Unbreakable, it's like, I've always been able to go back to it and just enjoy it like fully, you know? That doesn't matter if there's a twist or not. I like it. I like the whole of it. So, you know, it doesn't really base it on the twist. I feel like he's made a career on twists, and that he kind of, people judge him on that, you know? So, I don't know.
I want to say that, I mean, Shyamalan tried his hardest to get away from twists after The Village, specifically.
Yeah.
I'll be honest here. The Village twist is a really silly twist. Absolutely horrifically silly. It doesn't affect how I like the film, but yeah, after that, with Lady in the Water, he tried to do a movie without any kind of the normal twists that he was recognized for. The Happening, I think he wasn't intending the finale to be a twist, but more just kind of figuring out what was happening and setting up what was a really preposterous explanation for all the insanity, which I think was the point, I think, brought a lot of laughter to that film, but if it was meant to be suspenseful, it was totally, totally failed. And then, of course, well, we can all talk about the thing that was The Last Airbender. Yeah, no twist there, right? Other than how could you take a beloved animated show and totally destroy it? Right?
I kind of refuse to see it after its reputation, so...
Yeah.
So, with The Village, I saw The Village in theaters, right? And I saw it with a friend, and I think it was a bad cut of the movie or something, because you could see fucking boom mics and shit in the scenes.
Okay, you know what I found out? This is something that I figured out about 6 years ago, is that when it comes to certain aspect ratios, if the theater doesn't have it in the right ratio, you will see the boom mics. Because it wasn't intended, because they have in the wrong format. I don't know exactly the whole explanation for that, but that's the reason why. If they don't have it adjusted correctly.
But, so we laughed at that whole thing, you know? I mean, it was weird. It was like, man, big fuzzy mics in every scene and shit. It was like, dude, what the fuck?
Is that the theater
I had that same problem happen with me with X-Men The Last Stand.
Is that the theater owners screwing up, or is that the studio sending them the wrong
versions? No. That's the theater owner, but they didn't have the screen calibrated. You know how you have it in the 1.85 and the 2.35?
Right.
They have the screen adjusted for that as well. The problem is, though, is that they don't have it adjusted correctly, or if they don't have it synced onto the screen properly, you will see what's above and below that ratio. And when that happens, then that's when you get to see boom mics, because that stuff was intended to be out of frame.
Yeah. Man.
But yeah, I actually noticed that with X-Men The Last Stand. They didn't have that calibrated correctly. And so, yeah, boom mics galore on that.
Huh. Made the movie a little more entertaining, though,
I mean, that movie was already shit as it was. Yes. But yeah, that didn't help. Didn't help! All right, but okay, so with this being an interesting opener, also considering the fact that of this, only one character is going to come back in later scenes, and only for a handful of scenes to begin with, from there, we're introduced to Bruce Willis's character, David. And I have to admit here, I love this introduction. I love it being from the perspective of someone through seats. It gives us an interesting look, especially considering that we find out that it's this little girl that's watching everything happening. I love how it reveals information pretty quickly and pretty deftly, especially using kind of visual, not visual tone, not just visual tones, but kind of inflections. And understand, let's go ahead and let's just say it right now, Shyamalan's dialogue is really heavy-handed. There is no subtlety in his work. And even with great actors, they really have a hard time translating this material into something proper, right? Because, I mean, it's so stiff. It is, right? I mean,
he's just, not good just at listen writing, to how... Flirting.
I mean, David's pickup lines are, like, they wouldn't even be scrawled on a bathroom wall.
Travel often? No.
He's like, you know, is there a sport for synchronized swimming? Like, oh, I mean, this is on par with Anakin Skywalker's lament about sand. I mean, this is bad, right? I mean, come on. And this isn't as though Bruce Willis is making this up on the fly. At least I don't think so.
Probably not. And even so, Bruce Willis could probably make up a better...
I don't know. I've seen the whole nine yards, and they say that most of that movie was improv. Yeah. Anyway. But I do love this opener, and I love how it sets up the character. I love how it sets, you know, the especially considering that this character is possibly the most complex that we're going to have in the film, with the exception of maybe Elijah, right?
Yeah.
This is a character study of sorts. And I think maybe if we're kind of tying this back to comic book movies, I would say that the best comic book movies are the ones that are character studies. Can we agree to that?
I want to say yes.
Yeah. I mean, okay, well, let's experiment here. Okay. Name what you consider to be the greatest comic book movie.
Oh, shit.
I want both of you to do this.
There's a difference there, because there's a few that are really high up there. God, this is like trying to... You're forcing me to make my Marvel top list, aren't you?
It doesn't have to be Marvel, unless you think that DC couldn't do it.
Well, you've got, like, of the my top ones, original Superman, which we've discussed before, would be way up there. Which, you're right, that is a character piece. But also way up there, it would be Guardians of the Galaxy, which is just plain fun and really not a character piece.
Oh, believe it or not, that is actually a major character piece.
Yeah, you think so?
You figure out, you get to know.
Okay.
Star-Lord.
And then we're not even getting into Volume 2 territory.
Volume 2, I think, gets a little more character-wise. Because,
well,
especially since we're looking at
those characters.
Yeah.
But what about you, Chris?
I'm not sure. I don't have anything to add, I guess. I mean, all I can think of offhand is, like, Logan, which is obviously character study.
Yeah, it's absolutely character study.
Yeah. So.
No, the thing is that comic, because the thing about comic book movies, and one of the reasons why they make for great character studies, is because they are unique. That they are outside of the norm just by what they can do. That makes it so that you want to know more about them. And the film wants to explore those territories. If they don't do that, then it fails on that aspect. And for that, I'm going to go ahead and go towards Elektra. Elektra, they didn't explain what it was that she does or what kind of character she was. And considering the trajectory that that film was going for, it failed on the most important aspect that the film could go for. With Unbreakable, we have to be invested in David's plight. We have to understand why it is that he finds this situation to be incredible. And especially considering how he learns through the film how incredible this is. At first, you know, he survives this train crash and it surprises him and it depresses him. And from there, he's given an explanation that at first he can't go with because it's just so out there. And little after little, he starts to come around to it because he wants to an extent. He wants to believe in it so badly. And through this and that acceptance, not just that acceptance, but that responsibility that he also takes upon with that understanding is what propels that particular character. Whereas with Elijah, and this is where I think Shyamalan is pretty brilliant here, considering that it's Elijah that we see at the beginning of the film. It's Elijah who is behind the scenes practically pulling all the strings to an extent. But at the same time, though, he's looking for his own place, and he can't find it. He is the exact opposite. So here you are, it's not just a character study, but it's a study in contrast between these two characters, because we're constantly going back and forth between the two. But it's also interesting that Shyamalan puts more emphasis on David, because David at least is coming to terms with himself, whereas Elijah is not. Not until the very end, at least. Right?
Right.
If you think I'm wrong, Chris or Ken, I would please feel free to bring it up.
Let's analyze it more and keep going.
All right. Well, okay. Well, let's
and then when
go
we
into
get
this.
There, I'll yeah.
All right. So after this accident, and we're left with him coming out of the hospital,
yeah.
Which, by the way, I'll be honest here. When I the film teaser for this film was the scene in the hospital with Michael Kelly giving Bruce Willis the news about what happened on the train. That sold me on getting to see this movie. After that, I really want to see this movie because that was like, oh, what are we going to go here? What are we going to do here? And I will say for a good 3 months, I did wonder if he was dead all along. You know, just saying.
It's Bruce Willis in a Shyamalan movie. He must be dead. So,
well, I mean, seriously, though. I mean, you know, this is 1 year after The Sixth Sense.
But he won't repeat the same thing.
Well,
what a twist. We did the same plot. What?
Hey. I hate to tell you this, but most Marvel movies do the same plot.
Yeah.
Just saying. But all the same, though, I will say, though, that this that everything that comes after him coming out of the hospital also gives us more character insight. We find out pretty early on that there is serious relationship problems between him and his wife.
Yeah.
When he tries to hold her hand as they're going through the press, and she slips her hand right out. And then, of course, the fact that, you know, they're sleeping in separate rooms on separate floors, which... Okay, I mean, that's a very interesting...
Separate rooms is one thing, but, yeah.
Well, you know, any person that's been through a divorce can tell you that these are transitions going down that road. But also, we kind of get a sense of how how both of these parents respond to their son. They also... You know, the film also kind of goes through his work life. I will say that I think one of the problems that the film has, or at least not even a problem, but just kind of something that I kind of find very funny, is how the media really drops this really fast.
Oh, yeah. You'd figure they'd stalk him and every little detail of his life, they'd be following him.
Yeah, it's like old news, like 5 hours after he comes out of the hospital, right? It's like they don't stalk him to his house. No one's investigating him.
Reporter goes, wow, he's never had a sick day.
Well, so, I mean, that I don't think anyone's ever going to be thinking about his sick days. But I think it's very interesting, though, that we're led to believe that from the train wreck to the night, the night security, the night watcher, I guess I'll call him, that probably maybe, 3 weeks, 4 weeks go by. And that's being very generous.
Yeah.
Right? That's being very generous. And yet, not one interested local reporter isn't finding themselves interested in what's going on. This relationship between this comic book guy and this survivor, you know, so that's kind of coming out of the blue. I don't know, just for me, it just seems like there would have been a little bit more scrutiny put into the media. They would have been a little bit more interested, considering the circumstances, especially considering that we don't ever get the NTSB report, which you know would happen pretty quickly. And considering that we know that it was rigged, the NTSB would also know, so...
They denounce it. This was not an accident. This was sabotage.
Yeah, well, you have one survivor, right? Wouldn't he be the first suspect?
He'd be a suspect, but if there was any camera footage in that car, it would show...
But that would still keep media interest in this guy.
Yeah, they'd be interested, yeah. But they might... They'd go person of interest to whoever might have been in the engine at the beginning. Spoiler for the end. But,
and remember that he goes back into that warehouse with the remains.
Yeah.
Okay, let's put it this way. That ain't happening.
Yeah.
They would have secured guards around that place all the time because they wouldn't want any of their evidence to be tarnished and be ruled inadmissible if this goes to court. So, yeah, I'm sorry, but I don't buy any of that shit. And especially considering that this film is trying to go for a real-world perspective, right?
Well, it is pre-9/11, so...
That doesn't mean shit. Plane crashes and train crashes are still the same no matter if there's terrorism involved. And I think that they were ruling... apparently, they did cite Elijah being a terrorist on 3 counts.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't buy that at all. I mean, if y'all have an explanation, please feel free. But yeah, to me that is a little ridiculous, a little silly, say the least. But considering where this movie is going to go next, yeah, silly is going to be the name of the game for the rest of this movie. But I guess let's go ahead and let's move forward because then we get. We see Elijah as an adult at this point.
Yeah.
And we find out that he has gotten deep into comic books. We also find out why he got deep into comic books. And little by little, we figure out his obsession with comics, right?
Yeah.
Right. So what exactly does that make this character so much? Is he your average or even super average comic book geek, or is there something a little bit more off-putting before we find out the reveal?
Off-putting?
Yeah. Something more sinisterly obsessive.
Well, he's more about like...
Oh, I was just saying he's kind of zeroed in for bizarre reasons on our hero, David. But besides that, yeah, he's a higher-end comic book geek in that he has more money to spend on what he wants sent.
But exactly how? So, that's a question that I find myself asking, because...
How'd he get his money?
Yeah. That's a good question.
Unless he... Well, if he saved... Well, those weren't even 40s. Those were 60s. Maybe he came in right at the right time, grabbed the right issues, and sat on them in perfect condition for 30 years, and... Right at the beginning of the 90s, boom.
It's not that he has, like, vintage comic books. He has, like...
Original art.
Collector's art.
Yeah. He may have picked that up in the last few years, but... I mean, all that was big in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he could have been running his own store for a while, too. I mean,
and
that
remember,
gallery
this
is
set
impressive.
In modern time in 2000. Just,
right.
I mean, let's just take X-Men out because X-Men really, by the time that this film was being made, X-Men hadn't really come out. All right, so comic book movies, the highlights were, and I'm not kidding here, Superman, Batman, both of which were well over 10 years ago, and Blade.
Spawn.
Did you see the box office for Spawn?
Hey, what? Comic book people that saw it loved it.
Doesn't matter. The box office on it. Remember that in the mid-90s, Marvel was selling off their properties to places like Sony and Fox just to keep themselves alive. Right. And that's why we have the issue we have with Marvel.
There was the 90s bubble where they got so into alternate covers and chromium covers and just stupid stuff. And that ruined... By the mid-90s, that caused everything to start tanking. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of it. So if he was in it and out, it's kind of like short... What was it? What's the investment term? Shorting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If Elijah was basically shorting on comics, he could have made a fortune.
But that's the thing is where is the market? Remember, it's not just the fact that he has this. It's how is he going to sell it? How is he gaining this kind of money? And understand that what he does to destroy these things, to set fire to that hotel, to to wreck that train, that costs money and time. And really stupid people not really paying attention to, where people are going. But we'll get there.
Yeah.
But seriously, though, it's highly implausible for he must have been self-made prior to this. But we don't ever see that. And we see that he has like a custom vintage car that was designed with his fragility in mind, right? So it's...
He also could have made a bunch of money on, oh, I fell down and broke a leg. I'm suing. Okay, here's some money. Shut up.
That's what I was thinking.
I suggest that insurance companies tend to feed off people like Mr. Glass.
Yeah.
Yeah, they would make mincemeat out of him, especially if you tried him for more than once.
Now, granted, he's got the actual condition.
He does have
the actual condition. They can't say he didn't break something.
Yeah, but they also wouldn't say that there was a liability. It'd be well out of the realm of possibility. And Americans with Disabilities Act would only allow for so much. You know, you can't have padding everywhere. That's unrealistic.
Yeah.
But all the same, though, I just find it very interesting how he got this money and how he is his finance. Because, let's be honest here, he was living in, West Philadelphia, born and raised? Sorry, gotta throw it back. Nice. Oh, I'm sorry, but that was DC. Oh, sorry.
To ruin it, man. Come on.
Anyway.
Oh, boy. All right, but, okay, so this gets us to our meeting of the minds. Again, I find it interesting. Okay, so, he's going to the memorial for all for the people who perished in the train. And he comes out to find a note in his windshield. Again, still hiding it very hard that the media isn't keeping an eye on him, especially during a memorial. The media is not nicer to him than other people.
Or the church flat out said, we don't want any media, go away. That's the only reason. Yeah.
That would be in the church itself, but that doesn't mean that they wouldn't be around it like hawks.
Yeah.
So... But he finds a note on a business card. He goes to the store, and we get our explanation, which is, "You're a superhero."
You're a wizard, Harry. What?
Okay. How did y'all respond the first time that y'all saw the scene? Because I'll tell you right now, I kind of laughed my ass off.
It did seem kind of ridiculous. It's like, you're a superhero? Why? Why? Because you survived? Well, okay. But because you got lucky and... We're never actually told, was he thrown out of the train or was he found in the wreckage? That's a big deal. Yeah, because if you're thrown and don't have a scratch, that's questionable. If you're in the wreckage, hey, maybe the seatbelt worked.
You know? No, I take it that he was in the wreckage.
Yeah, which would be just fine.
But also, I will say, when it comes to that train wreck, just another thing to find interesting. The girl he was hitting on, she's dead. The little girl that we were watching.
Little girl was dead. She's dead. Everybody else in that compartment. That was hitting me that the little girl was dead. So, the chick, like, oh, well, whatever.
Dumb bitch.
She was a nice person.
She was nice. I'm feeling more for any children on her than...
And to just show just how big a movie weirdo I am, that's the general's daughter from The General's Daughter.
Okay.
Yes, I know these things.
Okay. Ooh.
I know. She had a lavish career after that. All right. Anyway, so, Chris, what do you take about this, this revelation that you're a superhero?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I didn't I guess I just kind of bought it.
You bought it right away?
I guess, because it's just like, I don't remember seeing it for the first time, you know, because I don't remember it all clicking together that this was a superhero movie when, because like, you know, it wasn't advertised as one. I don't remember it all coming together. So like every time I've watched it since then, I've known. So, I mean, I don't know, just kind of, okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I just kind of come to believe stupid shit in superhero movies, I guess. I don't know.
Well, the one thing I find very interesting about this revelation isn't so much what Elijah's telling David, but the fact that David's son is there, and he's also listening to this.
Yeah.
And so you get a juxtaposition of how David takes this information and how David's son takes this information. Because in a way, we get the idea that he really wants his dad to be a superhero, right? He wants to believe in this a lot more than his dad does. And I love how that actually escalates the more it goes on, the more that his suspicions are becoming more realized. The son takes more drastic measures to get his father to kind of follow along, right? And of course, it gets us to the gun scene, which we'll get to in just a little bit. But anyway, what do we take of Joe, of David's son?
Oh,
doesn't listen to his word. Did you get the idea that?
Huh? Yeah.
Did you get the idea that perhaps maybe that they were really wanting to have another young gentleman play that part, but he was just not available?
You know, originally when he was upside down on the couch at the beginning, I thought that was a certain other individual, but until he stood up and it's like, okay, this guy, okay.
Well, Spencer Tracy Clark, the funny thing was that wasn't the first movie I saw him in that year, because only 5 months earlier, he was another little boy watching another kind of superhero type fight in an arena as a gladiator.
Yeah.
See what yep. See
what I looked on for the geek sheet later on. Yeah, I saw he was in Gladiator. So
all I had to do was to see the name, because I had bought the DVD around that time.
Okay.
And yeah, he actually, his photos are a part of the DVD of Gladiator. So yeah, you know, they made a big deal about this kid, and of course now he's in Unbreakable, and it's like, oh, that's that kid. Yeah. Although he does look a lot like Haley Joel Osment in this movie, right?
Somewhat, yeah.
Just a little bit.
Sure.
So kind of like, well, we really wanted Haley, but he wasn't available because, well, you know, he's doing this whole Oscar thing. So let's get the other kid.
Good, yeah.
Stand in.
Anyway,
back to Clark's career as stand in.
Back to the character Joseph Dunn is played by Spencer Tracy Clark. Did you get the impression, maybe without it being written that way, but maybe played that way, that he might have had a slight developmental issue?
I just thought he was a disobedient shit.
There are certain people I know that agree with you exactly on that.
Okay.
I didn't
want to go disrespectful anywhere, but it did kind of almost feel that way.
I just thought that he was a stupid kid.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Same.
He just wants his dad to be a superhero. And especially considering that he's going through what is looking like a divorce. Divorce situation is happening.
Or pre-divorce.
It's his father that's going to be running, is going to be leaving. And this is something that he wants to think of his father as. I understand exactly where he's coming from. And I think that what Spencer Tracy Clark does here is he's really trying to get across this boy wants to believe in something. He doesn't have anything to believe in. And that's one thing that you'll notice in a lot of Shyamalan's films. He is, I don't want to say that he's a very devout religious person, but you get a lot of religion in his work. And a lot of it is shoehorned in deeply. Unbreakable is one of the very few that I think he actually does kind of pull back. And he does kind of allow those themes to kind of develop a little bit more, with a more nuance. Definitely a lot more nuance than we have with Signs that'll come out in his next film. But at the same time, though, it can get lost in all of the overall action, right? Because Did y'all catch on the religious and the spiritual themes of the film?
This film, not as much the spiritual.
Yeah, I don't think I caught that this time I watched it. Yeah.
It was more, almost more secular with what they were doing, but.
Oh, really?
For me, yeah.
So you didn't realize that this character basically dies and comes back to life, that he is...
David?
That he is given... Yeah, I mean, think of it.
After the train crash, he wakes up
and is told... Again, we don't know exactly what the condition he was in. And there, if for every reason we should believe that he had died, then he comes back. He is told that he is something super, that he is a super being, that he could use to protect and to save others, that he himself does not believe, but comes around to believing. And then when he does believe, is a savior who is reborn in water, mind you.
Are you saying he's Jesus?
A bald Jesus, yes.
Well, I think Bruce Willis would agree with you on that one, but I think he would say that about himself just naturally.
In a bathrobe.
Well, I mean, I kind of approach some of this as the, especially the interaction between father and son, as the Batman school of superhero. Just because you have powers doesn't mean you're a superhero. It's who you are.
But at the same time,
and
though,
he's not him. He's not a super. He's rejecting superheroism until a few. Until about an hour from now.
But he doesn't reject, he rejects the title of superhero, but at the same time, though, we see that he is still wanting to protect and to save. He is, that is a part of his life. You know, and on top of that, he also is someone who doesn't like to see pain.
Yeah.
He doesn't walk away from other people's pain. He doesn't say,
he has
I
compassion.
Don't care.
He does care. Well, there are people who also pretend that don't have compassion, but they just want to make sure nothing happens to begin with. But he wants to make sure bad stuff doesn't happen, and he cares, which are two very important things. But all kind of passively, not proactively, which is going to be an important distinction between when we get into becoming the hero.
Yeah.
Weird comic sound there that doesn't translate well.
It's actually the sound it makes whenever he puts the poncho on. So.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
His uniform, yes.
Well, I'm just saying. But okay, so, you know what, let's go ahead and talk about the gun scene. Since we're talking about Joe, we're talking about David, and this is the scene I think that is pivotal to that particular relationship. It definitely puts the cards on the table as to everything that's going on with these characters, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And definitely says the son should be in therapy.
Well, if
he's 100% right, that's not the right thing to do.
Well, that's true. But at the same time, though, we can understand why he does what he does, though. Even if we think that he's completely wrong in doing that. Because of that deep relationship that he has with his father, that he wants with his father. And what I love is that if you're listening to it, this was a relationship that prior to the accident, apparently that relationship was strained. That he really wasn't attached to his son, that his son was more what his wife dealt with. And through this accident, it really kind of caused it to a reboot of that relationship between him and his son, and apparently between him and his wife. That this has kind of made them reevaluate things, which I could definitely see being the case, because when you have something like that happen, it does make you reevaluate what is important to you, who is important to you, and I think that's one of the strengths that the film has, is it does understand that. Right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So, this particular scene sets up kind of that the son really wants his father to see what he sees. And his father is fighting. It's arguing and is refusing to see that. And I think that after the whole weightlifting scene, where it gives his son a lot more credence in that belief, right?
That was weird, because you figure being invincible would have nothing to do with how much weight you could carry.
Well, that's the
That's not. That means he has more powers than just Unbreakable.
Well, I think that that's what they're kind of setting up, is that he's not just that he can't be hurt, but that he's a protector, and protectors have to be strong. You know, it's kind of like how with Wolverine, you know, has that regeneration ability, but in order to fight, you know, his muscles have to grow. So as he's unbreakable, his strength kind of comes from that. So, I mean, he doesn't have like superhuman strength, but we do see that, and David does buckle under that weight. You know, it's not as though he's bench pressing it, you know, on his nose. He's, he has to struggle, you know, he has to pull that stuff off. Right?
Yeah.
But
the kid has other ways to tell whether or not he's truly invincible than shoot him.
Well, again, we're also dealing with a young boy that is under a lot of duress. And again,
yeah.
Remember that just before this, he's gotten the news that he's gotten the job in New York.
Yeah.
So his leaving is imminent. He needs to do something drastic right away to get that, to get his father to realize what he sees. And to him, this is the quickest way to do it. Now, we could say that this is not the best way, and we would be right. But again, we're not dealing with it from a rational understanding.
No.
We're talking about a young boy that has been through a lot. And from that rationale.
He could, I mean, it might be easier to find a knife and cut him. And well, go, look, the knife is broken, Dad! I hit you on the arm and it broke. Something's up here.
I don't know. Would you prefer to see a kid pointing a gun or a kid intentionally trying to stab their parent? Which would you think would be a little bit more violent?
Which would be more survivable if you're wrong?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. What about a frying pan?
Well, that's the thing is,
well, the frying pan, who cares? I mean, bang! Oh, what the heck? Put that
and
pan
he does
down.
Pass out. Understand, you know, he does succumb to, you know, to blunt force trauma. You know, he did pass out after the train wreck, right? Mm-hmm. So he's not invulnerable.
Vulnerable, right.
But at the same time, though, I do love the urgency of the scene, especially considering that he uses basically the same shot he did in The Sixth Sense when the mom goes out of the room and comes back and all the doors are open, right? Kind of setting up that... Yeah, that kind of intimacy. Having this all happen in the kitchen. I don't want to say it's in one take, but it definitely in kind of these long takes, this kind of building the tension, building what's going to happen. Kind of, in a way, do we want him to fire just so that David can see? You know, or do we have doubts that perhaps maybe David is, you know, that he would be killed with a bullet? What are your mind processes about the outcome of this?
He could be killed by the bullet. It could bounce off of him and hit somebody else in the room and kill them.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully
which would be a bad thing. It could pass through him, and then he heals Wolverine style in a weird way, which inconsistent, but yeah, something that could happen. And then the bullet still ricochets because it went through him. He could be unbreakable in most of his body except in like one area where he happens to get shot at
the eyeball.
I mean, we don't know where that bullet was going.
No, that's true. Well, what about you, Chris?
I mean, I guess he didn't get that far. I never thought the kid was gonna pull the trigger. He just seems like a pussy, so
Ouch.
Hey, I think he was gonna do it for science. I got told
no, I think he would do it too. Okay, you know, we talked about David's son, but we never talked about David's wife, soon to be ex-wife.
Yeah.
What do we think about her? Because I'll be honest here, she's a hard person to kind of nail down. No pun intended.
I don't think she's too well developed.
Kind of bland, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what the problem is in the marriage.
Well, we get the sense that they just don't talk to each other anymore. That there's a breakdown of communication. And I think that in a way that it was intended just that, you know, these characters have grown apart. That it wasn't that there was anything massive that had happened. It was just that they don't listen to each other. They don't talk to each other. They don't pay attention to each other. And I think part of it is that David has kind of withdrawn. And that's one thing that I kind of get from him, watching him, you know, at the dinner, at the breakfast table with the cereal, you know, him kind of staring off into space during work. He withdraws. And part of it is because the film is trying to set up the idea that he's withdrawing because he is not fulfilling his purpose. That his purpose is to be strong, be mighty, to do things and to become better than he is. And until he has this purpose in his life, that his life has no meaning. And so he has destroyed the relationships with loved ones over him feeling meaningless. And that's the best I can get from where all of that's coming from. If you disagree, feel free. And I'd probably say that there's probably an argument to made against that. But that's the best that I can come up with. But I'll say this, though. Considering, from what it sounds like, he basically lied to get with her. Lied to himself, lied to others, yeah. Lied to her to an extent. You know, he was a football star. He was something, you know, he found enjoyment in being strong and mighty, and she resented strength and mighty, being mighty. She doesn't find that to be appealing, and so he withheld that. And the thing about him saying that he was injured in that automobile accident that ruined his football career and him lying about it, did no one take an x-ray after that accident?
That's what I was thinking. Just one physical therapist or one team, not even the team doctor, one of the team, just an ambulance medic should have been able to look and go, I'm not detecting anything right now. Are you sure you're injured?
Like, yeah, I'm injured. Like,
could you take 5 steps for me? If you say you are, let's go get an x-ray.
I mean, even Dr. House would look at that and go, okay, if you're saying that you're injured, I want to find out where that's happening. Let's open this up.
Is there a nerve pinched somewhere? I mean,
this would be a medical mystery that would, definitely go down in history. But no, I mean, seriously though, his relationship was founded on a lie, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a lie that he was willing to make that ultimately kind of bit him in the ass moving forward. Because now, if we're taking what this film is saying, that he's now going to become a superhero, how do you think she's going to respond to that?
How long
is he going to be able to keep it a mystery?
Well, with that outfit, no length of time whatsoever.
Well, not just in that outfit, but also considering the fact that another individual also knows, and this kid has already got a blabbermouth.
Yeah. Hey, Mom, Dad's a superhero. What? Nothing.
Yeah, I'm telling you right now, when we get around to Glass, I seriously doubt that she's still with him.
She's not there. There's no way.
Huh?
He took the job in New York, I think. Yeah. He's
like, I'm a superhero. Peace out. Yep. Philly doesn't need another superhero. They got Rocky. All right. Yeah, I did it. I said it.
Anyway.
But all the same, though, as this is happening, you know, we also get the first moments of doubt with Elijah. You know, he's told that, you know, he had gotten, that he was sick, and, or that David had gotten sick in a pool when he was younger.
Yep.
And this starts him on a downward spiral, right? That he had thought that he had found the one, not to get too caught up in Matrix ease, but to have that taken away from him. And so he decides to harass a comic book store? I mean, I know some pretty obnoxious people in comic book stores. That's a new one. That is a new one.
Was it about the comic book store, though, or just, like, him, like, lashing out at the thing? Well, yeah, that. But him lashing out at the thing that he's kind of revolved his whole life around because, you know, he can't find what he's looking for or whatever. That's kind of how I looked at it.
But if that's the case, but the thing is that we don't get a scene prior to that kind of setting up this doubt. He's just basically throwing a temper tantrum in a comic book store. And then well, we find
that hair
he's
too,
looking.
You know. So.
Yeah. You know, and that's happening after you know the date that David has with his wife, which okay, can... okay. So she says, "Well, you can take me out on a date if you want," and all I could think of is, "Do you really want to be going out on a date with your wife, or you know, out on a first date with your wife?" That kind of, at the very least, sounds rather asshole-ish.
Could be an attempt to re-spark.
What the thing was is that she isn't taking the initiative. She's making him decide whether he wants to or not. And it's like, so do you want him or not? Do you, I mean, what do you want? Because I don't think the movie really answers that. Because it doesn't make it clear that she was really interested in keeping the relationship alive to begin with. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, she was, it seemed almost like she was the one that was calling it off, not really him. Although, you know, he was trying to get with that agent at the very beginning.
Yeah.
But his pickup lines are so lame. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he was intentionally trying to sabotage himself. Maybe that was the intention that Shyamalan was going for.
I think he became a superhero to have better pickup lines. Hey, bitch, yeah. I'm a superhero, you know.
kind of do the whole Batman 66 thing. You know, go to parties. Do the Batusi. A little bit, yeah.
Ooh.
Just saying. All right. But I don't know. Again, I find myself being annoyed by Robin Wright's character. Because she really doesn't... you're right. I mean, she is really underdeveloped. We don't know anything about what she really wants, what her needs are, what is it that she's wanting out of both this relationship and her life. And we even get a scene of her at work. You know, she gets a moment where Elijah is basically getting character information from her, and even then we really don't know what it is that she wants. We know that she doesn't like football, but that's pretty much it, right? I mean, and the reason why she doesn't like football is because it's violent. Even though, you know, she's saying it's more violent towards others. Like, no, it's more violence to the body. But, you know, they won't really talk about that for another 10 years. but all the same, though, I mean, is there anything else about her character that we really get to know that really kind of sets up her story?
That's what I can think of.
Not really. Too busy not making any sort of decisions on anything whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they totally fucked at the end of the movie, right? Like, when he went back to I Had a Bad Dream. They totally got it on. We can agree to that, right?
Ooh.
I guess. And then he went to New York, like, immediately after. Just pulled his pants on and walked out. That was it.
Well, are you saying that you don't find Robin Wright to be that...
She's Chris, fine. Like, she's just annoying in the movie, you know? It's just, I don't know what you want, and I'm sick of trying. It's been this long. Fuck
all right, then who's more annoying, her or her son?
Oh, the son, by far.
Oh, you are one harsh man. I'm just going to say that. All right. Okay, so let's talk about him accepting his superhero nature and... everything and kind of the setup for the end of the film, right? Do we even buy his acceptance to becoming a superhero? About him going back to the scene, kind of and kind of realizing, realizing his potential. Do we?
I'm just kind of wondering if he's like walking around now with like an inflatable tool toy around his belt and like water wings just in case he falls into a pool from here on out, you know? Instead of the poncho, something inflatable that'll actually fucking, oh wait, now I won't die, you know?
What, little floaties?
Yeah.
Yeah. Should be part of his costume now, just
totally
in case.
Totally should, yeah.
A life jacket. There do the whole Marty McFly thing.
Or just learn to swim.
I thought he just kind of
well, that wouldn't have
though.
Helped.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have helped because he got entangled. But
yeah. But seriously though, I mean, he all of a sudden accepts that says, "Okay, you know what? I am a superhero." You know that transition or not even that, that he just like show me what I need to do. You know, that felt a lot like it was a rehash of The Sixth Sense, right? Kind of the same thing about how the Haley Joel Osment character finally accepts that, you know, that he needs to do something with this ability, and so he follows through with it. He quote unquote listens. And we basically have the same thing, right? He puts his hands out. One thing, a little note that I realized that I just didn't pay attention to is, for the most part, Dave keeps his hands in his pockets for the most of the film. I don't know if you noticed this. He's doing that in order to keep himself from touching people, because apparently this is something that he does. Or, you know, if he touches someone, he knows something about them. Which, needless to say, just think of it on a logistics scale. How awful would it be that every time you touch someone, you saw the worst thing about them or something bad about them, right?
It wouldn't make me want to be a superhero, I think. So.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be like the most depressing thing ever. You know, it's like, you know, you touch them like, oh, I could tell that you had a, you know, you had a childhood trauma. Tough luck for you. Or, oh, I see that you, you know, you were thinking illicit thoughts of that nun back there. How dare you, sir? I mean, you know, I'll tell you one thing. I would hate to be his son. At that point, I think he'd be wishing not to be a superhero. Can you imagine? Like, 16, coming back home. Like, where were you? I was at the library. Yeah. All right, come here. Shake hands.
Hands.
Put it there, pal. You know, let's put it this way. I think that the son would be investing in isotoners. Just saying. Anyway. But no, but seriously though, I mean, you know, him going through the Grand Central, not Grand Central, but Penn Station, I think is what it's called. And, you know, we get all of these inferences of what awful things some of these people have done. And did you know that all of these things that they've done, you can't really convict without actual, like, proof?
Evidence, yeah.
And, like, the woman who stole the diamonds from the jeweler, like, did he not have cameras? I don't think she would have gotten away with that. Unless, like, that happened, like, in 1930.
The red dress made her inconspicuous, though. So.
That's true. That is true.
Just blended in the crowd. The little shuffle that she did.
Yeah. But I will say, though, that when we do get our final suspect, the one that we're going to be following home and have our final conflict, I was curious to see what they were going to do with this, right? How would they deal with this? And I will say that I kind of preferred the subtle nature that Shyamalan was going for. He was trying to make this weighty. He wasn't trying to make this a triumphant superhero thing, right? He was, in a way, kind of going with a Batman Begins type of vibe a little, right? This is David Begins. Mm-hmm. Also, I love the fact that when he goes for the bad guy, you know, the guy's throwing around like a freaking rag doll. It's like, you know, reminding me of that Bruce Willis is not exactly Schwarzenegger or Stallone in size.
Yeah.
You know, that you can pick him up and
throw him.
Yeah, well, I mean, did you, I mean, y'all remember Die Hard? Y'all remember how he, you know, that he constantly got thrown around in that movie? Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was nice to be reminded. Yeah, yes, Bruce Willis is not a towering figure. He's average-sized at best. And for him to be dealing with someone a little bit larger and a bit stronger, maybe, than he is. Until he broke his neck. And he broke his neck, right? He's dead. That guy is dead.
Yeah, he killed him by accident.
By accident. Or accident. I don't know if the eyes of the law would determine that an accident or not.
Yeah. For the greater good, though. Yeah.
Well, the kids he rescued would say for the greater good.
He got him wet, okay? That's serious business, you know.
I don't know if Philadelphia has the same acceptance of vigilantes as Gotham City. but I'm going to say probably not.
Oh, he'd be a wanted man for sure, but at the same time, you know, could you do it without killing people? That's what they'd say. So
that would be part of it.
Yeah.
But also, the thing that kind of muddies this is the fact that at the end of the film, David is the one that leads authorities to Elijah, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're told. So how exactly does he explain that to the police? Yeah, I touched his hand and it showed me that he did all these horrible things.
Like, you could just say he confessed. He told me he did it. Now come here, take a look at stuff real quick.
I'm the guy from the paper, and I say, this man is bad.
Yeah.
Here's my proof. Here's the article. That's wrong. Here's my poncho.
Yeah. We could definitely make inferences that would be less politically correct than already is the case around here, but we're not going to do that. So, yeah, we'll just say, how does he get away with not exposing his abilities or getting himself caught by the police? That is something that I wish that the movie would at least have set up, that his vigilantism is being sought out by the police. You know, if you're going to stay in this realm of realism or kind of pseudo-realism, you have to set up that there is going to be an impact on his existence in this world, right? Even if it's so much as police are searching for this guy for more information as to what happened. You know, it just seems like they're just accepting the fact that, you know, oh, we have this guy that's going around saving people. And that just doesn't feel realistic, would it? I guess in the same world where media is respecting people's privacy after tragedy, maybe we can take that into account too. But, okay, so let's talk about the twist. Let's talk about the Shyamalan twist. Did y'all see this coming? Seriously, did y'all see this coming?
It seems super obvious now, but especially with comic book movies, I always get wrapped up in them, and it's always comes as a surprise to me. And I'm like, fuck, I should have seen this coming.
Kent?
At the time, I did not see it coming. The first time. So, it was a surprise. So, of course, I'm remembering something 17 years ago. Oh my god. But,
you know, knowing that he has done those things, that final scene with David and Elijah's mom is even sadder for me, because I don't think she knew that her son was a terrorist.
Oh, no, she didn't.
No way.
She didn't know it. Yeah.
And to know that the person that she's talking to is going to turn in her son for the horrible deeds that he's done, not knowing all the horrible things that her son has done, that's sad. I mean, it just kind of hits me in a place that just is really emotional to an extent, right? Elijah's bad, but at the same time, though, in a way, didn't we kind of pity him a little bit during the movie? I mean, we've had several scenes where, you know, we kind of, you know, that we're kind of on his side. We wanted him to be right about David. We wanted, his beliefs to be upheld. We want to believe that all the things that he was doing was, you know, were beneficial, that were benevolent, right?
I think that's the ultimate form of twist is, we think he's a good guy the whole time.
Well, we thought that he was Xavier, and he turns out to be Magneto.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is the twist. But at the same time, though, I think that in a way, we're looking at it now, considering that Elijah is the character that we're introduced to at the beginning of the film, that maybe the entire film was Elijah coming to terms with who he is, that, you know, that in his finding David, in his creating David, that he has found purpose. And that the film itself is a testament to that purpose and not really David's purpose. And that's where, again, I don't know if that was the intention or if not. I don't know if I'm just making nothing out of this or making something out of nothing, but I don't know. I really don't. And part of that bothers me now that I'm looking at it on a critical level. But what do y'all think?
In general, or
yeah, you know, do you see perhaps that this is perhaps Elijah's story that we're kind of unfolding more than David's?
I mean, it almost feels like as Elijah's committing his terrorist acts, he's creating a group of heroes, or trying to, because we get word in those newspapers, if you read them real quick as they go by, there's others he's found.
I thought he said they were like failed attempts.
Yeah, they're all failed. David was the first that he found.
He defines them as failed. One of them said that a baby had survived the landslide, and it could be a failure because, too young.
Well, we'll see. I mean, especially now that we've established that there's a shared universe,
right?
With this, with other movies, that we might find out that that he had found more. But that wasn't what I took away from what we got from Unbreakable. But again, I mean, if even if he found other failures, I would take that as that they died. Or that they didn't meet his criteria. That they survived, but they survived with massive trauma. You know, they couldn't be strong.
Or they rejected the idea of being a hero.
There's that. But he doesn't seem like the type of person that would just be like, okay, that's not working. I'll see
or
you
they've,
later. You
know? Or they've decided to become super villains.
Ooh.
Probably
not.
Maybe not, but we don't know.
Well, I guess
he's
we'll
trying to
create
a hero and
all right. Is there anything else that we wanted to bring up in regards to this film? I think I've hit my wall.
That's it.
Yeah,
I must say so. Yeah.
All right. Well, Kent, why don't you get us the geek sheet for this?
For the most part, this is a fairly simple geek sheet. I mean, we've got Bruce Willis right at the top of casting list, and we know him from Die Hard. We know him from a few other comic book related movies, too. Also, smaller titles. Try and remember what some of these are.
Well, we talked about him in Pulp Fiction.
Red, G.I. Joe, both comic book titles. The Surrogates, also a comic book title.
I forgot about Surrogates.
Surrogates, yeah. But that was Sin City.
Ooh, yeah.
I mean, he's not a stranger to the comic book worlds, so...
And Robin Wright had actually just had her first foray into the comic book world.
I was going to say, you know, our Princess Buttercup, Robin Wright, but yes, also now a General of Themyscira, so...
The dead General of Themyscira. Oh, spoilers!
Yeah. And let's just tiptoe around Samuel L., we won't say it, Jackson. Unless you really want to say it. I know you want to say it.
You want these motherfucking superheroes off this motherfucking plane?
Oh, I thought you were just going to say Samuel L. motherfucking Jackson, but...
that's already a given. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, yes.
I mean, this is the man who initiated the BMF.
Besides his work in Tarantino films, coincidentally alongside Bruce Willis in Pulp Fiction, also, you know, Nick Fury for God knows how many movies now.
Are you forgetting their first foray together? In a certain other Die Hard with a Vengeance?
Oh, they were both in with a Vengeance together. Sorry.
Yeah, co-leads. Wait,
that was before? Okay. So,
well, it came out around the same time as Pulp Fiction, but...
Okay, maybe, Pulp might have been first. And then, you know, eventually he's also a Jedi who will never use the word motherfucker. So,
also, did you notice that Samuel L. Jackson was a huge fan of purple in this movie, and what was his lightsaber color?
Purple.
Just saying.
Yeah.
Just saying.
So, whatever. Getting deep in note, Spencer Treat Clark, for a short time, not a movie role, but was on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, that's so, true. And we actually talked about Spencer Treat Clark before.
We did?
Yes, we did.
I was going to say, we haven't done Gladiator, so what was that for? Oh, Mystic River!
Yes!
How did I miss that kid? Ah!
I can't believe you forgot about that.
Okay, I forget. Yeah, well, how many episodes have we done?
Not that many.
Nice try, you know. Oh, not that many. We're getting Yeah. Yeah.
We're getting close to the two.
Yeah. So, anyway, and we already, well, you talked at length about our, is that cinematographer?
Yep.
Yeah, who also did the last two Harry Potter films. So, yeah. So that's geeky enough. What else have you got?
Well, I would also go ahead and bring up that we have music by James Newton Howard, who has done a lot of amazing scores, and his work with Shyamalan on most of his more impressive work. His most notable for me specifically is obviously his work on Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, okay. Along with Harry with Hans Zimmer. Also, he did a great score for The Fugitive, which I think was possibly one of his best kind of jazz fusion types. Yeah, he's done a lot of interesting scores, but those are the most memorable ones. But he all has another. He has others that are in that same realm. But also, let's see, that's pretty much it, I think. Yeah, that's all I'm going to go with right now.
Okay.
All right, so, gentlemen, are we ready to call it?
Sure.
I believe so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chris, Kent, do you agree with the critics on Unbreakable? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent.
I greatly say this is one of... This could be very high up there in the comic book movies of all time. Not up there with Superman. I'll die on. But very high up there. Definitely, it's... If you think about it as a superhero movie without really being a superhero movie, then yes, it is... It sets up its shocks, its twists very well. I think after this is when Shyamalan kind of... You know, it's very easy to detect. Like, no, this was... All the hints were there, but you don't see it till the end. So, I'm passing this movie in a big way. And, yeah, I'd recommend the DVD we've got, but I don't think this DVD is... Not sure if the Vista series is in print anymore. But has some nice comic book-related extras on it. So,
Chris!
It's Unbreakable is one of my favorite Shyamalan movies. It was my favorite before Split. It's got a few flaws here and there, and some of the characters are annoying. But I mean, what comic book movie isn't flawed in some capacity? But I don't know. I really like the perspective and the camera angles are really different and unique, especially for a comic book movie. Especially like the stuff he does with Glass before, or Elijah Price before he becomes Glass. It's really cool stuff. I really like the movie. It's really great. It's a definite pass for me.
So I'm a firm believer in M. Night Shyamalan, even when I am not the biggest fan of some of his movies. I think that Shyamalan has a lot of talent, and I think that a lot of that comes through in his earlier work, specifically in The Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, and Signs, and The Village to an extent. And then, of course, he falls right off the map. And I know that a lot of people would disagree with me. A lot of people don't like any of his work. And I can definitely understand why. Unbreakable is a movie that, when I was coming back to it, I find that there's a lot of problems that I have with this movie. And a lot of it is that just little attention to detail and the fact that Shyamalan was trying to create a realistic world, but then he breaks it. Every moment that it was inconvenient for him. And I think that that's the problem that I'm having with this take. The emotional elements I really appreciate. I love how the characters are kind of trying to find themselves in the film. But the thing is that the film itself does tend to meander. It does tend to muddy its waters. And it doesn't explain things that... it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And it's one of those things like, I appreciate it. I still think that I like the film. But I think that the critics and the audiences kind of are ignoring some major problems that the film has. That they aren't taking into account that, yeah, this story is severely flawed. And maybe I'm just, maybe I was being very, very nice to it and on its, you know, upon its release in the times that I have seen it. I still say that Signs is a brilliant film, and I will fight to the death. But I gotta admit, Unbreakable has kind of broken off a little from me, and I'm gonna have to go with a maybe this time. I know. I was expecting this to be a straight, strong pass, but yeah, there's some serious problems. And I still like it. It was like with Fargo, when we talked about Fargo. And that one I failed, flat out. It's a movie I still like, but it's got problems. And this movie does too. And but the thing is that these problems don't break this movie like the problems with Fargo broke that one. So there is that. But it does leave it kind of weak. And if you're weak, you can't be unbreakable. So, yeah, maybe is my final judgment. But, gentlemen, I think we have one more episode for November. Kent, what do we have coming up?
We've got an indie that came out this year that, you said could be up for Best Picture this year. Big Sick.
I will put money on it.
Yeah. So.
And what would that movie be?
The Big Sick.
So join us for our next episode as we discuss The Big Sick and what I think has got a lot of potential for end-of-year awards. We'll hope maybe my opinion might change once we talk about it again. I don't know. Apparently, I'm unpredictable that way. So, I know. I just left two people aghast just recently.
I know.
There you go. But if you have anything you want to say about this film, if you want to agree with me or disagree with me or tell me how wrong I am for everything, you can do so on Twitter at Arthouse Legends or on our Facebook page. Or if you want to make it a private affair, you could always email us arthouselegends@gmail.com and we'll get back to you. But gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. This is the Movie Dude Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And beans.